The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Ireland officially takes its seat on the UN Security Council for a two-year period. This will be Ireland's fourth time on the Security Council, having previously served in 1960, 1980-81 and 2001-2002. Now, to talk about what this will mean for Ireland and much more, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, is on the line. Minister, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Now, first of all, you are currently restricting your movements at the moment. You were a close contact of a positive case. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much. And I, like so many other people, I'm working from home. And I've, although I think people are almost getting used to it at this stage, but I've set up an office in my home and ensuring that the kids don't run in and in the middle of video conference calls and so on. But that's the new realities that we're living with. And obviously, I'm restricting my movement at the moment because I was a close contact with someone who tested positive. When that period ends, I'll be working from home as much as I can, but I will have to work like some others do for essential work as well. And some of that will probably involve travel abroad because we have... we have responsibilities as a country, and I'm the foreign minister, and I'll need to do that under tight protocols around testing and so on. But and it looks like we'll have probably 2 days a week of the Dáil, which seems to be the likely recommendation of the Ceann Comhairle. But apart from that, I'll be like everybody else, working from home and trying to restrict social contacts as much as I can, because we are in the teeth of probably the most aggressive period of spread of the virus over three waves of COVID-19. And we've really got to try to bring it under control. The only way that happens is if the whole country works together. This isn't just about the government, although we have a responsibility, of course, to give leadership and clarity of message. But this has got to be a collective effort nationally to get this under control one more time. While we hopefully see the benefits of the vaccine being rolled out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not going to rehearse any of this stuff about the vaccine and how many we've done and how many we do that with other ministers and with the health experts and so on. But generally speaking, about you talk about clarity of message, and we had a U-turn because the union said we're not going back into the classroom with those leaving certs. And it does seem as if it's a bit chaotic that it wasn't checked with the unions in advance that this was even possible. It's announced and then you have to backtrack. That doesn't look good.
No, but I mean, I think, look, you know, our focus is on looking forward. This is something that that I think is certainly regrettable for the government, because we felt that it was consistent with the view of the chief medical officer and NPHET that schools could stay open for some students, students that have special needs, who I think would really benefit from the structure and predictability of being able to go to school each day, and also for Leaving Cert students for 3 days a week, because you know, we as a government really want to try to create as much normality in young people's lives as possible. And a Leaving Cert year is hugely important in terms of formation and, of course, opportunity to go to college and so forth. So the government really wants and still wants to.
You know, it's a long time since I did the Leaving Cert, a shorter time since you did it. And all I can say from memory, distant memory, is that there wasn't too much difficulty getting me to put the head down in the Leaving Cert year. Fifth year, and there wasn't transition in my time, but transition year and fifth year, a bit more difficult. But you could easily get the, you know, where it's possible, where they have laptops or tablets or whatever, the Leaving Certers will put their heads down. They could do remote learning probably far more effectively than the other years.
Yeah, and they are going to be, you know, and that's going to be the focus. You know, I think teachers have done an incredible job through the last 9 or 10 months of COVID. And, you know, I'm sure teachers will focus now on trying to make remote learning work for their Leaving Cert students for the next few weeks. The government's preference was that we would have interaction in the classroom for just Leaving Certs for 3 days a week. But I, you know, teachers unions have said very clearly that they don't want to do that. And I think the government, you know, isn't going to create tension and a big distraction with a disagreement with unions.
But do you take my point about the messaging, the clarity of messaging? We got the big announcement about restrictions, and then suddenly one of them is removed. So
no, I do, of course. But I mean, you know, we can focus on mistakes that have been made, or we can focus on trying to galvanize message and support now moving forward to protect people. And I can assure you that is the focus of government. You know, this is, as I say, we would rather schools were going back next week for leaving certs for 3 days. And of course, schools were open for special needs. That hasn't proven possible. And now we need to adjust and react to that, which we're doing. And Minister Foley, I think, did that quickly last night. And there'll be
the next step has got to be sure
footed.
I want to move on to your own bailiwick, which is foreign affairs, and we'll talk about the Security Council in a few moments. But because you've been at home, you've probably been able to devote a little more time to CNN and watch the events unfold in Washington. What was your reaction to this carry-on?
Well, I mean, my overall reaction, I think, was one of sadness to see a country as global and as dominant as the United States in terms of its role in the world to protect democracy and the fundamentals around democracy deteriorate into complete chaos at the heart of its capital. And you know, I've been in Congress and in the Senate on many occasions I've had the privilege to be there representing the Irish government. And you know, to see the scenes of, you know, carnage with effectively, you know, hardline, violent individuals essentially ransacking people's offices, taking control of the Congress chamber. I mean, it was shocking, really.
What you're saying now, you've tweeted, shocking and deeply sad, but you said, we must call this out for what it is, a deliberate assault on democracy by a sitting president.
Yeah, and I don't resile back from those comments. I think they're accurate, and I think they've been shown to be accurate by comments from both sides, both Republicans and Democrats, in the last few days, in the last 24 hours. I mean, undoubtedly, the actions of President Trump contributed to that mob mentality and the levels of hysteria and aggression that led to effectively the storming of Capitol Hill, which is just completely unheard of, has never happened before. Five people have lost their lives because of those actions.
The most recent death announced was that of a police officer who, it appears, was hit over the head with a fire extinguisher in the Capitol buildings. I mean, this we're now talking about, if not murder one, murder two. We are talking about a very serious outcome. Do you think that President Trump should be brought to account on this?
Well, look, I think that's a matter for politicians and leaders in the United States. And, you know, I'm not certainly going to prescribe how the US should respond to this, but I felt the need to call out something honestly and bluntly. Even the most powerful person in the world should not be free of criticism at a time when he was clearly inciting and encouraging a mob to effectively march on Capitol Hill. And that is how I saw it. I think that's how the vast majority of people who watched what was happening the other night saw it as well. And we are incredibly close to the United States in so many ways. We have extraordinary privilege in terms of access to the White House, to Capitol Hill as an Irish government. because of that relationship between Ireland and the United States. But
this
like
man,
so many
this
others,
man has been demonstrably bonkers for quite a while and out of control. I mean, is this what we do? We stay silent until he's absolutely without power and he's going out of office. Even the rats in the White House are deserting the sinking ship. But we stay silent because of that access.
Well, we haven't stayed silent. So let's just be clear on that. You know, on policy issues, on international affairs, I have not been silent in relation to the approach of the Trump administration in many ways, whether that's the Middle East in terms of the treatment of Palestinians, whether it's the Iranian nuclear deal, which we now have a specific responsibility on the Security Council, mm-hmm. where I have been very much supporting the EU position, which is contrary to the US position, whether it's on climate change, which we've been very strong and clear on, and most importantly, the approach to foreign policy, which from an Irish perspective is one of supporting multilateralism through organizations like the EU and the UN, which the current US administration has largely rejected. Instead, they have looked at effectively bilateral, transactional-based foreign policy, if you like, which is almost based on you're either with us or against us. That kind of approach from the United States has been very corrosive in terms of international relations. The tension transatlantic between the EU and the US has been hugely unhelpful in terms of solving many global problems that we can only solve together. And that's why I have, and I've called that out many times. I have never been personal in terms of criticism of the US president, and I don't think we should be, except when a US president is essentially inciting the kind of reaction that we got from a crowd in the last 48 hours in Washington, which is, you know, anti-democratic. And I made the comments as I did because of that. But, you know, our focus has always got to be on having a good, constructive relationship with the White House and a US president. But we've also got to be open to criticizing the approach of the US when that's appropriate. And I think I've been consistent on that. But, you know, I hope
And we'll come to how that might play out in the Security Council. I mean, you will be dealing with the US and the other permanent members who have the power of veto. You'll be dealing with those, or our representative will be dealing with those. Just before we leave the Trump circus, I mentioned some of the rats deserting the sinking ship when it's too late anyway. But Mick Mulvaney was the special envoy, former chief of staff for Donald Trump, special envoy to Northern Ireland. He said he couldn't serve anymore. Not that it makes any difference, because he would have been replaced anyway. Did you ever have any dealings with Mick Mulvaney?
Oh, yeah. I've had lots of dealings with Mick Mulvaney. And he's somebody, you know, he's an Irish, very proud Irish-American. He asked for and got the job of being effectively a special representative of the US in Northern Ireland, which I think was a very welcome appointment because Mick cares a lot about Ireland and the Irish peace process, as so many Americans do, both Republicans and Democrats. And we have many, many friends on Capitol Hill. And Mick Mulvaney was one of them, is one of them. So, I've had lots of dealings with him and lots of phone calls. I don't think it's right to just dismiss it as not really relevant because it's a sinking ship. I mean, I think for someone like Mick Mulvaney, who has been as close to President Trump as he has been for most of the 4 years of the Trump presidency, I think for him to say enough is enough, I can't serve under President Trump any longer, was a signal to a lot of others as well that enough is enough and the United States need to take back their country now.
Now, the role in the Security Council, we have been given our committees and women, peace and security, the Iranian nuclear deal, as you've already mentioned, climate and security and Somalia aid. How do you see our tenure on the Security Council unfolding? I mean, what exactly will our role be? How can we be influential when there's always a veto hanging over our heads?
Yeah, and look, I hope your listeners will find this interesting, because this is, you know, if you're into foreign policy and if you're into how Ireland can influence the world, there isn't a bigger opportunity than when Ireland sits on the UN Security Council. I mean, this is the body that literally decides on war and peace internationally. decides on how the world should intervene by agreement through the UN Security Council in times of war, conflict, post-conflict, peacekeeping, and so on. So it's a big, big deal to be one of 15 countries sitting around the table making these decisions. There are five permanent countries on the Security Council: Russia, China, the US, the UK, and France. Whether you believe that that's balanced or not is a different question, but that is how the Security Council is currently structured. And then there are 10 temporary member states, if you like. So we're there for a two-year term, and those 10 rotate all the time on the basis of elections. So Ireland didn't just, you know, decide to be on the Security Council. We actually had to win an election, which was highly competitive because we defeated Canada, who are a friend of ours, but also a big power on the UN. And Ireland got more votes than Canada to get on the Security Council. So 130 out of 192 countries voted for Ireland to be on the Security Council, which is a huge responsibility. Many small and medium-sized countries in particular trust Ireland as a voice for them, as an independent voice, as a voice that has good relationships with all five permanent members, but also can be independent and can be a voice for the EU on the Security Council. So that's essentially the background to how we got on. And then when you're on the Security Council, of course, like there are meetings every week of the Security Council. And in many ways, you know, events determine how the Security Council has to react on the decisions it makes in terms of what happens in different parts of the world. And we will be one of 15 responding to events as they happen. And then we've been asked to take on specific responsibilities in certain areas. So the Security Council has a whole range of committees that effectively then have to report back to the Security Council in the areas that they have responsibility for. So the areas that Ireland have effectively put up our hands to take on responsibility in terms of chairing committees or being what's called a coordinator or a facilitator in a certain area are all important and in some cases very controversial and very political. So first of all, there were very few countries effectively putting their hands up to say we would like to take over the position as facilitator of what's called the JCPOA, which is the Iranian nuclear deal or nuclear agreement that supposedly will prevent Iran developing a nuclear weapon. That agreement has been under extraordinary pressure in recent years. The Trump administration have effectively pulled out of that agreement. The EU are trying to keep the agreement intact, because it guarantees inspections and transparency in Iran in relation to what they're doing. Because the US have pulled out, Iran are now breaching the agreement in a very dangerous way. And so we are hopeful.
They're still way off having the concentration of enriched uranium they need for a weapon.
Yes, they are. So in Ireland's view and in the EU view and in the view of most countries in the world, not all, but most countries in the world, this deal is still savable and worth saving. And even though there are many problems and tensions with Iran in terms of regional conflict and so on across the Middle East that are valid and need a response on the nuclear issue, this is, I think, the best deal available, and we need to try to save it. And so Ireland is now officially the facilitator for the JCPOA on the UN Security Council. In other words, it'll be up to Ireland to put together agendas and meetings in terms of trying to bring people together on this question. And I'm hopeful that because of a change of administration in the US, that that job may be a little easier and less divisive. But believe me, it's a highly contentious issue.
Absolutely. And we obviously will have a high profile in that regard. Yeah. And we'll talk about the other committees perhaps on another occasion. But I want to read this to you from Glenn, one of our News Talk listeners.
Other areas, Pat, just very briefly, because I think people might be interested. We're also going to be chairing what's called the Sanctions Committee on Somalia, which is about really peace on the Horn of Africa. We're going to be chairing a committee on women, peace and security, which is about women's rights and gender and ensuring that women are part of peace processes around the world. We're going to be chairing what's called the Climate and Security Working Group, which is about trying to get acceptance on the Security Council that climate change is a major contributor to security issues and conflict around the world, which some on the Security Council still don't accept. But in my view, over the next couple of years, we will be able to convince them that they need to accept that. And then finally, which people will be interested in, is ensuring humanitarian assistance into Syria, which is a hugely important one from an Irish perspective. There is only one international access point into Syria, where there are literally millions of people relying on international humanitarian assistance. That only international access point into Syria through Turkey is under threat to be closed because Russia wants to close it. We have a job to do to try to convince them to keep it open. And that is from a humanitarian point of view and from an NGO perspective is hugely important.
Now, this is the text I wanted to bring you from Glenn, one of our News Talk listeners. When it comes to the UN, Ireland is regarded as world-renowned because of the unique services of its defence forces, regarded as one of the most professional, loyal and steadfast militaries. Yet, morale is at its lowest point in generations, multiple ships tied up, operational units depleted of strength, all due to pay and conditions. The minister will wax lyrical, that's what they do, but that doesn't feed families or pay mortgages. The irony of our vaunted place on the Security Council while our troops work second jobs and apply for welfare. No respect. That's from Glenn.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that that's a view, and I've heard that view from many people. But I mean, Glenn also needs to understand that you can't just simply decide to pay the defence forces more and not do anything else in terms of the broader public sector pay arrangements. You know, Ireland works differently to that. We have a public sector pay deal. We've just concluded a round of negotiations around public sector pay. My job is to make sure that the defence forces, right across the defence forces, are treated fairly, and that we find ways within public sector pay arrangements to improve pay and conditions and to make a career in the defence forces more attractive. And I am setting about doing that. So, you know, we have a specific problem in the naval service. We've responded to that separately to the public sector pay agreement by introducing a new scheme of financial supports for people who go to sea in the naval service. I think in time that will help in retention and recruitment for the naval service. We've done something similar for the Air Corps, and it's had a very positive impact in terms of increasing the number of pilots that have come back into the Air Corps. There is now no longer a shortage there. We've set up a commission on the future of the Defence Forces with a really high-powered group of 15 people who are setting about taking on all of these
questions.
Conditions,
you know, you're going to have to do something special for the Defence Forces outside of any agreements with the rest of the public service.
We are doing something special for the Defence Forces. That's why we've set up. There is no commission being set up for any other sector. In terms of pay,
are you
conditions,
not facing,
strength,
therefore,
balance,
oh, the army
so
got
on.
This, therefore we want the same? Is that the inevitability of the way
and
trade
that is
unions
why,
work?
Yeah, and that is why in the programme for government we have said that there needs to be a separate pay body for the defence forces to the rest of the public service, because working in the defence forces is unique. It's different. They don't have the opportunity to strike. They can't take industrial action. There are special terms and conditions with being in the defence forces. And so we have to have special arrangements for them to recognise that and to make sure they get a fair deal. The defence forces are Ireland's last line of defence when there is a national emergency. We're seeing the benefit of having the defence forces there in terms of COVID challenges right now, around contact tracing, around testing, around special transportation arrangements, around bringing tests to German labs, using Air Corps facilities. So, I am someone who asked to be Minister for Defence for the second time. I recognise that we have real challenges in the defence infrastructure that we have in Ireland at the moment. We are about 1,000 people short in terms of where we should be. And that is why we have pursued such a proactive course of action in terms of correcting some of the mistakes that have been made, and also rebuilding morale within the defence forces. And I can assure you that's going to have my attention over the next few years.
Okay. There's a complicated case of Richard O'Halloran, who's prevented from leaving China since March 2019. It's kind of, he's a commercial hostage. Are you familiar with that case? And will you be able to do anything about it?
I'm very familiar with that case. I've spoken to Richard by phone. I speak to his family regularly. This is, I would say, the number one consular case anywhere in the world in terms of the time and resources that the Department of Foreign Affairs is putting into any individual case. I've written to my counterpart in China now three times, the Chinese Minister for Foreign Affairs, and I've spoken to him about Richard's case. There are things I can't say on the radio because I don't think it would be helpful to Richard's case, but I can assure both the family and friends of Richard, this is a big priority for me personally and for the Department of Foreign Affairs, and we are doing, continuing to do everything within our power, one, to protect Richard's welfare while in China, because he has found his circumstances extremely stressful and difficult, and his family are worried about him. But secondly, he has been involved in a court case in China. In my view, he is guilty of nothing wrong, but he has, but the company that he's associated with has been involved in a long drawn out court case, and we are trying to bring
anyway, you're working that case. A final question today, Minister. Air passengers to Germany from Ireland will be refused entry from today unless they can produce a negative COVID-19 test result. Are we going to do the same for China, for Germany? I mean,
no.
You know, can they come in here?
Yeah, they can. They can, although we are looking
at... So they test us, we don't test them.
No, but this isn't a tit for tat, Pat. That's not how these things work. They work on the basis of public health advice. And so, you know, just because Germany are doing something that impacts on travel from Ireland to Germany doesn't mean that we just reciprocate. We make decisions on international travel on the basis of public health advice. We are now requiring all passengers from tonight, midnight, anybody who's flying from the UK back to Ireland or getting a ferry from the UK back to Ireland will have to have a PCR test to show that they're COVID negative within 72 hours of travel. We may well extend that beyond the UK only to other EU countries as well that potentially pose a COVID risk beyond the normal acceptable risk. You know, Germany has made a decision on the basis of the strain that has come from the UK is now clearly evident in Ireland. They're concerned about that. But I have had a communication from the German foreign minister this morning to explain the context of their decision, but also to say that they are very anxious to reverse that decision when the conditions allow. So, you know, this is two friendly countries working together on the basis of public health advice. That's the way the European Union should be working. And that's the way we work as well with the UK, by the way. You know, as soon as we can free up international travel safely, we'll do that. But we've got to make decisions on the basis of public health advice right now.
Mm. All right. We will leave it there. Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, thank you very much for joining us.